We come back tonight to our study of Abraham and the book of Genesis. We've kind of been jumping around a little bit and haven't quite followed an exact linear path through Genesis and even through Abraham's life. And certainly two Sunday mornings, last week and the prior week, and preaching from the life of Lot, and planning to do so over the next few weeks, although in 2 weeks we are going to have our Work and Witness Sunday. But we've spent a lot of time in the book of Genesis in the last year and a half, and I preach more from Genesis than any book in the Bible, and we're kind of in that series. Of course, Genesis is an important book. It's a beginning foundational book for the authority of God, and what you believe about God's authority and what you believe about creation and you believe about His revelation at the early days of mankind is very important. And studying Genesis has a lot of value. And as I say, to me, one of the reasons to study the book of Genesis is to study the authority of God and think about the authority of God. And certainly so many other books of the Bible you could say the same thing of, but Genesis helps to affirm to us the authority of God. I also think it helps to affirm in us the character of God, and we see God's character. We don't always understand everything about it, but we see, as we study the Bible and we go through different parts of the Bible, we see a fuller picture of who God is. And that's one of the great benefits of studying all the Bible, to see who God is. I want to invite you tonight to chapter 20 of the book of Genesis. We're going to read the whole chapter. Basically, it's one story in chapter 20. And then we're going to get into it a little bit, the context of it. And this is a Bible study tonight. And there's something I believe that we can hear and God can help to apply to our hearts. I'm not sure what it might be for you. I know when I've read this story and thought about it several times, a couple things have come to me. And so let's read Genesis chapter 20, beginning at verse 1. Now Abraham moved on from there into the region of the Negev and lived between Kadesh and Shur. For a while he stayed in Gerar, and there Abraham said of his wife Sarah, "She is my sister." Then Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent for Sarah and took her. But God came to Abimelech in a dream one night and said to him, "You are as good as dead because of the woman you have taken. She is a married woman." Now Abimelech had not gone near her, so he said, "Lord, will you destroy an innocent nation? Did he not say to me, 'She is my sister'? And didn't she also say, 'He is my brother'? I have done this with a clear conscience and clean hands." Then God said to him in a dream, "Yes, I know you did this with a clear conscience, and so I have kept you from sinning against me. That is why I did not let you touch her. Now return the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you will live. But if you do not return her, you will be sure that you and all yours will die." Early the next morning, Abimelech summoned all his officials, and when he told them all that had happened, they were very much afraid. Then Abimelech called Abraham in and said, "What have you done to us? How have I wronged you that you have brought such great guilt upon me and my kingdom? You have done things to me that should not be done." And Abimelech asked Abraham, "What was your reason for doing this?" Abraham replied, "I said to myself, 'There is surely no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. Besides, she really is my sister, the daughter of my father, though not of my mother, and she became my wife. And when God had me wander from my father's household, I said to her, 'This is how you can show your love to me. Everywhere we go, say of me, he is my brother.' Then Abimelech brought sheep and cattle and male and female slaves and gave them to Abraham, and he returned Sarah, his wife, to him. And Abimelech said, 'My land is before you. Live wherever you want.' To Sarah he said, 'I am giving your brother 1,000 shekels of silver. This is to cover the offense against you before all who are with you. You are completely vindicated.' Then Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech, his wife, and his slave girl so that they could have children again. For the Lord had closed up every womb in Abimelech's household because of Abraham's wife, Sarah." This story is very much like what happened to Abraham some 25 years earlier when he was in Egypt. There are some similarities in this story to the story found back in chapter 12 and chapter 13. In fact, if you just kind of didn't pay attention to the details, you would think, well, maybe this is the same story I read earlier. Maybe it's a telling again of what happened to Abraham in Egypt. When you read these events, unless you read them closely, you might think, well, this is the same story. There are some real similarities between what happened in chapter 12 and 13 and what happens here in chapter 20. However, there are many details that are different. The truth is, there are three stories in Genesis that sound very much alike, and they all involve this issue or the protection of a man's wife that took place during this time. And all three of these stories have some very close parallels and similarities, but all three of these stories also have some different details. And so, you know, most certainly they are different stories, but they took place because similar themes happened. The first two in the life of Abraham, and the third one in the life of Abraham's son Isaac. The third story, which we haven't talked about or looked at, is in chapter 26. And it involves not Abraham, but involves Abraham's son Isaac and his wife Rebekah, and the same name that we find in chapter 20, Abimelech. And it's like when you read that story, you think, wait a minute, that's what happened right there, the same people. And until you study it a little bit deeper, you would think, well, did this really happen again? But we do find the circumstances and the details are different and and changed. And so you read chapter 12, Abraham's in Egypt. In chapter 20, it takes place what we read here. And in chapter 26, then you have Abraham's son, Isaac. Now, that can be very confusing. This does reinforce, though, some of the things about Abraham's day that help us to understand a little bit the culture. I mean, the fact that there's three stories and they're all kind of centered around this moral question of a man's wife, a man's sister, the king and his harem, Pharaoh the first time, and now King Abimelech this time, it does kind of help us at least to be aware that there are some cultural background and cultural moral norms that existed in that day that we really don't understand. I mean, we didn't live 3,500 years ago, and so we really don't know exactly what the expectations of the day were and the moral norms were. This, of course, was long before Moses. This was long before God gave the law and the Ten Commandments on Mount Sinai. And so man was operating even at this time without the specific guidelines of the law that God would give. Now, we do believe, and I believe at least, that God spoke to people during this time and all the way back to Adam, and we're told in the Bible that He spoke to people, but there wasn't the kind of the agreed upon express law of God that was given. That would be given later, but for now, they operated on kind of moral codes. Some people obeyed them and followed them, and they were good people, and some people did not follow them, and they were evil and wicked people. But there were cultural norms of the day, and these stories kind of fall into that category of realizing that what we might think seems really strange, and boy, that really is wrong, or that seems so different than how we, for example, understand marriage. We understand if there's a sister involved or a wife involved. It's just that the moral code of the day was different than now. And we probably can't necessarily compare right and wrong and all these stories we find of the patriarchs and just compare them to the moral code that we believe and accept in today. For example, in the area of polygamy and having more than one wife and what Abraham thought about that and you know what Jacob thought about that, for example, and other patriarchs. The moral code was different then, and sometimes we might know and see the nuances of the differences, and sometimes we might not quite get it, or we wonder about that. Well, in regards to marriage, for example, in Abraham's day, there was a certain right that kings had. They had a right to look at the unmarried women. Now, this is a generalization. It wasn't true everywhere. But they had a right to look out in their city or in their province, and if they saw some beautiful young lady that they thought was very attractive and that lady was not married, they could say, I want her for my harem. And so, if the king wanted you for the harem, you came into the harem. You think of the story of Esther and that whole idea of finding a queen, and he didn't just want to bring one in, but they searched for all the beautiful women of the kingdom to bring them in. And you understand that the kings of that day, there was a whole different moral code about that. Obviously, there was also a moral code that we kind of elusive, and we want to try to capture a little bit the moral code of a man's wife. And so you have the norms of a man's wife, and apparently there was more risk of the man who is wealthy being knocked off, and so his wife and his goods can be stolen in that day. But if it was the man's sister, then it was the moral obligation of Eastern hospitality that a man would pay for her. And so there were issues about whether a man wanted people to know who his wife was or not. Again, I know we don't have all the nuances of that, but we just know that they existed, and we don't always know. Sometimes it's harder for us to catch these nuances of the stories, and this is a good place and a good example of that. Another cultural norm that we see throughout the patriarchs, and we still have it a little bit today, or somewhat today, but maybe not, is the importance of the eldest son. And he receives the blessing. He receives the birthright. Now, that's a little bit different in our culture, in our society today. but you know what I mean by that expectation. My daughter Jennifer's husband, Hakeem, their culture, it's very important who the eldest son is. And Hakeem's the eldest son. And he has a lot of responsibility. Even though he lives in the United States and he has siblings in Nigeria, it's his responsibility to look after his siblings, and he calls them every week and checks on them and asks them how they're doing in school and are they behaving themselves. I don't know what he expects to accomplish by doing that, but there's expectations of the eldest son, and that's kind of one of those cultural things that are very strong in the Bible, but we might not necessarily think about it in the same way. and so these things that we'd call nuances or cultural norms or whatever, we might not be accustomed to. But as we look in this story, we realize that it had to take place within certain cultural norms of the day. We also know in this story that there's a specific timeline that this story had to take place. And the timeline is a very narrow window. And when you look at chapter 20 and what comes before and afterwards, if indeed this part of Genesis is consecutive, you realize that this story had to take place after the three visitors came and told Abraham and Sarah that they're going to have a son within a year, and the time that they had a son, a year later. And so it's a very narrow time that this story takes place. It's a one-year window. That means, if we see Genesis and this part as being consecutive, it means that it had to take place right after Sodom was destroyed. And Sarah may well have, she could have been pregnant by this time, maybe early in her pregnancy. And I'll talk a little bit about that a little bit later. Some commentators kind of believe and think that this event actually may not have taken place chronologically where it is in chapter 20. Maybe it did take place earlier, and they point to some possibilities of that, that maybe it fits better right at the end of chapter 12 when chapter 20, verse 1 says, Now Abraham moved on from there into the region of the Negev. That's our story, but you go back to chapter 13, it says, So Abraham went up from Egypt to the Negev. So at least twice, Abraham moved from somewhere else to this area of the Negev. As I said, some commentators think that maybe it's not consecutive, but I'm gonna speak and explain what I see in the story as if it is consecutive, because there's no evidence directly that says that it isn't. So if indeed we believe that these chapters are consecutive, we know it had to take place within a one-year time period. On the other hand, perhaps God, more than just allowed Sarah to be pregnant, and maybe it could be when God blessed Sarah and said, "You're going to become pregnant," he did more than just allowed her to conceive, but perhaps he renewed within Sarah her youth and vitality. And some commentators think, well, that seems to be what the story is saying. You have this 89-year-old lady who is well past her childbearing years, and she knows it. She calls herself an old woman, and boy, that has cinnamon in it. What did you say that had? Apple. Oh, that's cinnamon something. John. Anyway, some people think that when God blessed Abraham and Sarah, it wasn't just that he allowed her to conceive, which he did, but he kind of reversed her aging. Now, nobody really knows. The Bible doesn't go into that much detail. But it kind of fits a little bit this story that comes after that. That all of a sudden, Sarah seems to be a young, beautiful, attractive woman again, which she was before. So much so that Pharaoh in Egypt said, "Wow, I want her." And she's described several times in the book of Genesis earlier as being very beautiful. Now, she may have been a very beautiful 89-year-old woman. That's possible. But it could also be that the miracle of the conception with Abraham and Sarah that seems so utterly unbelievable, and Sarah, when she heard the messenger say it, says she laughed. There's no way. But somehow God allowed her to conceive, and perhaps he also allowed her to kind of renew or rejuvenate her youth and her great beauty. And so you come to this story, all of a sudden they move somewhere and the king notices her. The other thing about that that kind of seems a possibility is Abraham moves, and kind of the timing of when he moves. It's after Sodom and Gomorrah. It's after God destroys Sodom and Gomorrah. And Abraham did live in the hill country that could look down into the plains of Sodom and Gomorrah, which on this map behind you would be kind of toward the southern end of the Dead Sea right there, from Beersheba over a little bit. Nobody knows exactly where. For a time, Abraham lives in Hebron, which is very significant. That's kind of the home of the patriarchs. Can you see Hebron? It's kind of in the middle to the right of the red circle and then up just a little bit. That's the area that is kind of attributed to Abraham spending the end of his life. And today in Israel, Hebron is considered where Abraham was buried and where he lived. But before then, he lived south and over toward the Dead Sea. And right at the bottom of the Dead Sea is the area that is thought to be where Sodom was. And so perhaps after the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, when God destroyed, as you remember, not only Sodom and Gomorrah, but all the cities of the plains, that then Abraham moved away, and he moved east, and he moved toward Gerar, which is circled on the map, and that's the direction that Abraham went. So the timing of the story might fit two things. One, maybe God did rejuvenate Sarah in her youth and her beauty, but also Abraham was moving away from what happened at Sodom and Gomorrah and all that part of it. Well, if you look at this location, Abraham is moving east from what would have been the area a little bit to the south of Sodom and Gomorrah, and he moves to the area called Gerar, and he settles in this town named Gerar. Gerar was the town that would later become the capital of the Philistines. Now, again, this is long before Moses and the people of Israel come into Canaan land, and God tells them to wipe out the people who are there, and you have this continuous fighting with the Philistines, especially through the days of Saul, and then David, and then finally coming to the end of Solomon. But Gerar will become the capital of the Philistines. And if you know much about Israel, as you look at that map, just to the left of Gerar is the Gaza Strip. And the Gaza Strip, and north of there along the coast, you have two towns, Ashkelon and Ashdod. Those are all Philistine towns. You read about them in the book of Judges. Basically, Abraham was living in what we think of as Palestine territory during this time, and the present-day Gaza Strip. We're told in verse 2 that Abimelech was the king of Gerar. I'll look at that. It says, for a while he stayed in Gerar, and there Abraham said of his wife, I lost my place, she is my sister. Then Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent for Sarah and took her. Well, let's look at this man named Abimelech here. The name Abimelech is found quite a few times in the Old Testament. If you get a concordance out, you'll see the name Abimelech about 60 times. However, you condense them down to about 5 stories that involved an Abimelech, and most of them are here in Genesis in this chapter, and then 6 chapters later when this story seems to happen again. So there was more than one Abimelech. For example, in the book of Judges, one of Gideon's sons' name was Abimelech. There's another Abimelech that's described as an army commander. And so it would seem that Abimelech was a common name, and it also became, later on, Abimelech became a title for the king of Philistine king. And so throughout Philistine history, there were many people that were called Abimelech. For example, in the same way that you had Pharaoh in Egypt, Pharaoh was a title. Abimelech became kind of a title for a local Philistine king. Later on, you have in Rome, Emperor Titus, Emperor Flavius, Emperor Nero. And so the name Abimelech becomes a title for those that controlled that area of Gerar and the Philistines. But in Genesis chapter 20, the name falls on the local king named Abimelech. And then in chapter 26, you have a second Abimelech that this story takes place with Isaac. It's not the same Abimelech. It actually was a grandson. So between Abraham and this story in chapter 20, in chapter 26 and Isaac, you have two kings named Abimelech, but they're actually father or a grandfather and grandson. And so it can be confusing when you're trying to study that. In fact, in the story of Isaac, it's the king named Abimelech that tries to take Isaac's wife, in the same way that this Abimelech tries to take Abraham's wife. Well, we also know from this story that Abimelech, at least the one found in chapter 20, was not like other Canaanite kings at all. In fact, this Abimelech seems to be a righteous man. He seems to be a man that listened to God and feared God. I know we have an impression that everybody in the Canaan land worshipped polytheistic gods, meaning they worshipped other gods. But that's not true. There are some examples in the Old Testament of Canaanites who worshipped the true God, and Abimelech seems to be one of them. Probably later on, Abimelech could be described what the New Testament calls a God-fearing Gentile. Not of Jewish stock, but someone who believes in one God and worships the one true God. And so Abimelech appears to be, even though he's a Philistine king, and you know that's just almost a dirty word when you read later in the book of Judges and the Philistines and Samuel and 1 Kings, but this Abimelech seemed to be a God-fearing man. When God spoke to him in a dream, he responded. And I will say about Abimelech too, in this story, not only did he respond, but he responded immediately. It says that as soon as morning came, he got up and did what God told him to do. There seems to be no resistance in Abimelech. Abraham assumed that there was no righteousness, no righteous people in this area, but Abraham was wrong. And he judged Abimelech, and he judged him wrongly. Instead, Abimelech was a God-fearing man and immediately obeyed what God told him to do. It also seems from this dream that Abimelech may have had a very good relationship with God, in that God speaks to him in a dream. Abimelech talks and boldly talks to God, and God continues to speak to him in a dream. Now, who does that remind me of? That reminds me of Abraham. Our story last couple Sunday nights ago was of Abraham, who boldly prayed for and interceded for Sodom and Gomorrah. And he talked to God and he boldly told God, "You can't do that. That wouldn't be righteous if you did that." And in the same way, Abimelech, in his own self-defense, kind of says to God through this dream and this conversation, "God, this wouldn't be right if you would punish me. I haven't done this. I've had a clear conscience." Abimelech speaks directly to God, kind of like Abraham did. God spoke to both Abraham and Abimelech in a dream, and both responded to God. Both responded by obedience. Both responded by faith. In fact, in verse 4, I notice it says, "Now Abimelech had not gone near her, so he said, 'Lord, will you destroy an innocent nation?'" Two things about that. He says, "Lord." He uses, I understand, the word that acknowledges the one true God. Hundreds of years later, Abimelech says, "Jehovah." He calls him Lord. In other words, "My Lord, my God, how could you destroy this nation or destroy me?" He has this relationship with God that's obvious at this point. It shows that Abimelech worshiped the true God. He seems to have been honest and forthright. He certainly was with Abraham. And boy, when he has an opportunity to call Abraham in, he just lays it right on line. He said, "Abraham," he's honest with him. He doesn't try to deceive him. He's also very conscientious. And he says that to God. "I have done this with a clear conscience and clean hands." Abimelech says to God, "God, you know already, but you know that I haven't done anything wrong here at all." And God also then says, "Yes, I know, Abimelech, you've not done anything wrong. You have had a clear conscience. And because of that, I have kept you from sinning and falling into this sin." Well, so far when I talk about Abraham and Abimelech, it just seems like you can compare these two men. You can compare their behavior. You can compare their righteousness. And in this story, I think it would be hard to argue against believing that Abraham was any more righteous than Abimelech. In fact, everything about this story tells us that Abimelech did what's right. Go on to that next slide if you would, Nate. But you can compare the sincerity of Abimelech, and you can later compare his generosity and his honesty and his forthrightness and his all that obedience. And then you look at Abraham. He's afraid. He doesn't trust God. He's deceptive. And so we can really see in this part of chapter 20, and boy, we're after God's already revealed himself to him and Sarah. I mean, Sarah may be even pregnant at this time, but what do we see in Abraham? We see weakness. We see him falling back to a weakness that was shown in Egypt when he didn't trust God and believe that God would protect Sarah even after God. I mean, here, the angels or the messenger said, "Abraham, by this time next year, you're going to have a son. You and Sarah are going to have a son." And it seems that Abraham already has struggled with and maybe stumbled in trusting and believing God. That's what it seems like in this story. Abraham is fearful. He doesn't seem to believe that God's going to protect Sarah. And so he falls back to what happened in Egypt. He's deceptive. And when he's confronted by Abimelech, what does Abraham do? Abraham makes excuses. Everything that he says here. Now, compare this to Abimelech. Abimelech, God speaks to him in a dream, and it says, early the next morning, Abimelech summoned. I mean, as soon as he got out of bed and the dream was over, Abimelech got up, and he wanted to do what was right. He gets on it right away. Abimelech's not going to wait. Man, he's going to make sure that he does what God told him to do. I notice the boldness that Abimelech has with God and with his people. He's not afraid. He's not afraid to say, "God told me this, and this is what we're going to do. Don't you dare touch Abraham or Sarah." He's not afraid to proclaim his innocence. He's bold about that. And he also believed that God would do what is right. I mean, he said, "God, you wouldn't you wouldn't punish an innocent nation. That's what this is. All these things are kind of things that, well, boy, we wish Abraham did this. And later on, then, Abimelech is very generous, and he shows great ability to want to be reconciled and make sure that everybody knows that he doesn't want to do anything wrong. He says, Abraham, here's all these gifts. And, man, Abraham really comes out pretty good in this story again. What does he get for this? And his deception and all these things, God allows by his mercy and grace Abraham to be blessed. Why? Because God chose a man to change the world. Why does God do that for Abraham? Well, we do find throughout these stories that God's hand is uniquely on Abraham. And God goes so far beyond justice here. God shows mercy to Abraham and grace, you could say, to Abraham. What do we see in Abimelech? We see generosity. We see sincerity. Abraham seems to be the weaker of the two here. Once again, God had chosen Abraham, and God protects Abraham even when he doesn't deserve that. And I think of, what is God's mercy? It is undeserved. It is when we do not deserve it, but God gives it to us anyway. And I think this story is an example of that, and a little piece. Unless I'm missing the culture or missing something, Abraham didn't deserve to have all the sheep and the cattle and all these things, but God poured it out on him. God shows his grace and his mercy to Abraham. He also shows his grace to Abimelech. He doesn't allow Abimelech to fall into this sin. Even through his innocence, God says, Abimelech, I'm going to protect you. I protected you from this all along. I think it's like God was saying, Abimelech, I saw this coming. I'm sorry. That's what Abraham did. You know, I've been working with Abraham a long time. I knew this was coming, but I kept you. I kept you from sinning against me. So God's hand was on Abimelech too, but his mercy was on Abraham, it would seem to me. And so maybe we see in this story a snapshot that reminds us that God works with imperfect people. And even the greatest of the Bible were not perfect. You know, the greatest people in the Bible, whoever you would choose, you know, whatever character, whatever Old Testament, you know, whether you like David and Goliath, or you like Daniel in the lion's den, or you like Noah and the ark, or whoever it is in the Bible, nobody was perfect. Now, we don't know. We were not told everybody's faults and weaknesses, and maybe some were a lot better than that. Like Daniel, there's nothing about Daniel that's negative, and there's several people like that, but pretty much we know that everybody in the Bible was imperfect except one, and that's Jesus. And when we read this story, we're reminded Abraham's the greatest character in the Old Testament. I mean, he is the father of Judaism, the father of Christianity, and the father of Islam in some ways. And yet he was imperfect, and God worked with him. The truth is, it's not your perfection that brings God's love to you, and God's favor, and God's care for you. It's not that you're perfect, so therefore God will use you. The truth is, God uses people who are available to him. God used the amazing man Abraham, who was amazing in some ways, but he was weak in other ways. God works with imperfect people. Sometimes, I think church people, Christian people, kind of, they know they have weaknesses, they know they have faults, and they make a decision about it. That causes them to say, okay, I can't be used of God. Instead of saying, I wonder if I just keep trying and I keep giving myself to God, if God might use me and God might change me. God might work in me in order to be a little bit more like Abimelech and a little bit less like Abraham. If God is able to work in imperfect people in the Old Testament and the Bible, is he not able to work in you and me? And God can work with anyone who sincerely comes to him. And God worked in Abraham's life and his character. That's what impresses me when I read this story. God works with imperfect people. God will work with you and me. I mean, we know we're in that category. We know that already. But the truth is, are we teachable? Are we able to learn? Are we able to say, God, you're in charge? Whatever I think, whatever I feel, whatever my personality is, whatever my experiences are, am I able to give them to God and let God work in them? The truth is, God uses imperfect people. He uses people with bruises and warts and faults and all those things to do his work in his kingdom. And God used Abraham. God was protecting Abraham. He also, as I said, protected Abimelech from falling into a very messy and ugly situation. God knew he was innocent and told him, get out while you can. He came to Abimelech at the right time. You know, for whatever reason, he waited for a while. Who knows, maybe to teach us, I don't know. But God was protecting his plan. God was protecting his promise. He made a promise to Abraham and Sarah. He's going to keep that promise. I mean, here we are within a year of when the baby's to be born, and the whole plan just looks like it could blow up. I mean, what if Abimelech would have slept with Sarah? And then the question would have been, well, whose baby is it? You know, and whatever. You know, I'm just speculating about all the what ifs could have happened. But at the right time, God stepped in, and he said, no, no, this is not going to happen. And he protected an innocent man in this case and said, get out. God always knows when there is a tiger behind the door. And sometimes in our lives, there may be a situation that we're not aware of, but God always does. You know, there might be a situation that could be very, very dangerous. Maybe dangerous morally. Maybe dangerous financially. Maybe dangerous in a broken relationship. I mean, you know, there could be any number of things. And God already knows what's behind that door. God knew what was behind the door for Abimelech, and he saved him from it. Abimelech spoke truthfully, directly, and immediately to Abraham. I notice, you look at verse 9. Early the next morning, Abimelech summoned all his officials, and when he told them all that had happened, they were very much afraid. Then Abimelech called Abraham in and said, what have you done to us? How have I wronged you that you have brought such guilt upon me and my kingdom? You have done things to me that should not be done. And Abimelech asked Abraham, what was your reason for doing this? You know, Abimelech didn't sugarcoat it to Abraham just because he was the prophet of God. He spoke the truth to him. Said, Abraham, you're wrong here. What you have done is wrong. And I'm afraid Abraham's response, it just doesn't seem that strong either, because what does he do? Number one, well, he does admit he was afraid. He was afraid. In other words, I didn't trust God enough. Then he said, and I judged you. I thought there'd be no fear of God in this place. Abraham says, instead of asking God, I assumed and I got it all wrong. There's a lesson in the story right there. You know, sometimes we can think we know. We can be pretty sure about people and motives and circumstances, and we're just reminded we better be careful. We've had a couple stories like that recently. Lot's another one. Boy, when I just want to hammer Lot, and I was really about to hammer him a couple weeks ago, and I still did, but I did have to remember that he's called a righteous man, and I think, you know, God sees things that we don't, so we better be careful about judging. And just be careful that we don't believe we're the judge. I mean, we all have opinions. We do. You do. I do. And we think we know, but we better just make sure that we always leave room. We always leave room for God to be the judge and know that it's up to him. And we better always leave room, because when we close the door and we know, we really can get it wrong. And we can hurt people. And we can be wrong about circumstances. And there's several stories in the Bible that remind us of that. Abraham judged. Also, Abraham kind of told a lie, a half-truth, whatever you want to call it. Yes, Sarah was his sister, but he was protecting the truth that Sarah was his wife. So whatever you say about that. And then fourthly, in verse 13, I just read this and it kind of caught my attention. This is how you can show your love to me. Everywhere we go, say of me, he is my brother. Abraham kind of said, hey, we've been doing this for 40 years now. That's the way we always do it. And I don't know if that was really Abraham's tone of voice. So I don't you know, I'm not sure, but I'm just suggesting at least a possibility. Abraham kind of said, you know, I've been doing this way all along. Somewhere along the line, it'd be better for Abraham to step back and say, you know, maybe I should trust God more. Maybe I can believe that God can protect what he said he would protect. Chapter 20, it is a lesson in the weakness of Abraham, but it's also a lesson in the mercy of God. God even calls Abraham this man that has weaknesses, but God has his special hand and his favor upon him. And I notice here, interesting, what does God call Abraham to? Boom, he said he's a prophet. You know, it's the first time that word appears in the Bible. Not Noah, which kind of surprised me, and I've thought through other people in the Bible up to this point, and Noah would be the one that, but you know, God never calls Noah a prophet, but he calls Abraham a prophet. Why is that? Once again, God proves to us that he sees the long term. God sees the lives of people. He knows how they're going to turn out. He knows what they're capable of. He knows their potential. And God always knows far more than we do. And so whether you find yourself being a little bit more like Abimelech or Abraham, remember, don't give up. God sees you with an everlasting love. And he's patient. He's kind. He's merciful. He's protective. And he knows what's behind the next door in your life. Let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for chapter 20 and this story. I pray that you would apply it to our lives and our situation, and Lord, to our decisions, and whatever you want us to learn and you want us to hear, help us to hear that, I pray, in Jesus' name.